when Khrushchev gave his secret speech, some of the first information that the West gets from gets that this has occurred comes from Marshal Gretschko's wife, among others, who are making calls back to relatives in Berlin.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Steve Vogel is a veteran journalist who reported for the Washington Post for more than two decades. He's also the author of Betrayal in Berlin, a new book that tells the story of one of the West's greatest espionage operations of the Cold War. Now, I'm sure you are enjoying your weekly dose of Cold War history and you'd like to continue to do so. So I'm asking if you wouldn't mind supporting us by paying at least $3 a month. Higher amounts are welcome too. It's very straightforward and you can stop whenever you want. Plus, monthly supporters get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. You can also help support the podcast by leaving written reviews in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. We've recently had some great reviews from Sir Gifts, Neil Gussman, Mr. Mark N4CC, and Walshy Joe. Thanks so much for those great reviews. So, back to today's episode. Steve's dogged research unearthed recently declassified documents in US, British, and German archives, many of them secret for half a century. He interviewed dozens of key participants, many of whom have never spoken before about their roles. We welcome Steve Vogel to our Cold War conversation. Now, I really enjoyed Betrayal in Berlin, right up my street. Do love a good espionage story, and one set in the Cold War is the icing on top. And this story has been one that's fascinated me for quite some time because I have read quite a lot about George Blake, who's a key character in here. But can you just quickly explain to our listeners about Operation Gold and what that was intended to do?
Sure. You know, it's important, I think, to put yourself in the context of the times. This was back in 1950s Berlin. So this is before the Berlin Wall was built, obviously. And that was a period when Berlin was truly the espionage capital of the world, because you had a divided city between the Western powers and the Soviet Union. But you still had more or less free access across the sector borders. And Berlin was also more or less the hub for a lot of communication networks that tied together Eastern Europe back with Moscow as well as to the west. Berlin was more or less the center of the hub with all these spokes coming in. And the other important thing to recognize about this time period was that at this relatively early point in the Cold War, the United States and its Western allies, Great Britain in particular, felt themselves being quite shut off from intelligence about the Soviet Union and about the Red Army. At the conclusion of World War II, the Americans were still getting some very valuable intelligence from this intercept operation where radio traffic from Soviet radio traffic had been intercepted and was being deciphered. And that continued until 1948 when the Soviets discovered the interception and they more or less stopped using radios as nearly as much as they had in the past, and they also changed their encryption system. So this period was known as Black Friday, because the United States and its allies suddenly had very little good information about the Soviets and their intentions and the Red Army and their capabilities. And this continues for a number of years. And this period we're talking about, the mid-1950s, was also before you had any of that overhead surveillance that would fairly soon become much more commonplace. You didn't have the U-2 flying overhead, for example. And of course, there wasn't any of the satellite surveillance that would later become such a big deal. So the United States and the British felt themselves in many respects blind when it came to the Soviets and their intentions. And their anxiety was heightened by the fact that the Soviets had at this point exploded nuclear weapons. They had successfully tested their first nuclear weapon in 1949, thanks to some Manhattan Project secrets that had been stolen. And then they, much more rapidly than anticipated, they also exploded a hydrogen bomb in 1952. So you had the American President Dwight Eisenhower, in particular, felt that he was not getting good intelligence. He feared a nuclear Pearl Harbor, in essence, the Soviets launching a first strike against the West, and the United States not having any intelligence beforehand, any warning that this was happening. So that's basically the story behind Operation Gold and the Berlin Tunnel, which was more or less the Western answer to this dearth of information. They came up with this scheme to dig a tunnel in Berlin to tap into Soviet communication lines. Again, this being before the Berlin Wall, so this was a tunnel not to escape out of Berlin, but an attempt of Western espionage to tap into Soviet secrets communications.
Right, and this was based on a similar operation that the British had done in Vienna, because Vienna at this time was also split in the same way that Berlin was, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly right. And the British Secret Intelligence Service had done a quite successful operation, Operation Silver, that had successfully tapped into Soviet communication lines in Vienna. And in the case of Vienna, these were pretty small tunnels, and the Soviet communication lines in Vienna traveled through the Western sector. So these were relatively simple tunnels and taps to pull off, these lines going underneath buildings and streets and in the portions of Vienna controlled by the Western Allies. Peter Lunn, who was the chief of station in Vienna, was more or less the mastermind for that, for SIS. And based on that success, which the Americans had learned about because the British were sharing the intelligence with them, both the Americans and the British became interested in Berlin as a place for a much larger operation.
Right. And did the Russians rumble Operation Silver, or were they unaware that?
They were unaware of it until after it ended. That was one of the things that George Blake would be involved in informing the Soviets, the KGB, about, until George Blake would gave them that information. They had no idea that they'd been losing it.
I hadn't realized it was called Operation Silver, which makes some sense around Operation Gold, but that seems a bit more of a predictable operation name to use. I mean,
yeah.
Anyway.
I agree.
So where or how does the Allies work out, you know, what location to use for Operation Gold?
Well, this takes place over quite a period of time. There was some exploratory work that was being done, and this had really started as early as 1952 or so, as they started targeting Berlin for an operation of this sort. And the CIA base in Berlin was instructed to try to penetrate the East Berlin or the East German Ministry of Telecommunications, which controlled the cables that the Soviets were using for their communications, and they were pretty successful at penetrating the ministry. In part, again, because Berlin was such an open city, they were able to get access to a lot of people who worked in the ministry who didn't necessarily feel fondly about the Soviets or the East German communist government, or had relatives who were working there. And they were able to recruit a number, and in the end, some 20 different people who worked at the ministry or in some affiliated way, you know, ranging from senior attorneys to sometimes even more valuably, the clerks who filed the index cards that had the information on which cable was carrying what traffic and, you know, which, where these cables went, the circuit diagrams, the maps that showed the streets underneath which these cables ran. And some of the CIA officers in Berlin, two in particular, Hugh Montgomery, being one who I interviewed for the book, were able to recruit different people at the East German side and get those drawings and maps and information on the circuits. And from this, they were able to put together a good overview of where these cables ran. And there was one or two places in particular that seemed promising. And the most promising was in the southern edge of Berlin, right on the border between the American sector and the Soviet sector, where the cables ran within less than a quarter mile of the American sector border. And that the Americans and the British eventually agreed was the place to launch the operation. It was right near the East Berlin village of Altglienicke, which was part of Berlin, but was almost like a separate little village in a rural part of Berlin, not the center of the city by any means.
Right. And how long did it take them to construct this tunnel to reach those cables?
Well, even once they identified the target area, then they had to assemble the teams to do it. And this was not something that the CIA or SIS were able to do on their own. They had to get the help of both the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Royal Engineers, and also the British Post Office. They weren't able to do this on their own, so it took quite a while to put together those teams. And you had the engineers, the American engineers were training out in New Mexico in the desert. This team that was put together with top secret clearances and specialties that they could that would be helpful for digging a tunnel of this sort. And meantime, the Royal Engineers put together a team. The Americans and the British each brought certain, I guess you could say, talents to the game. In the case of the British, because of their experience in Vienna with the tunnels there, they had the real expertise on tapping. This was going to be a tap on a scale never before attempted. We're not talking about a few lines here and there, this officer's phone or you know, that person's teletype communications. We're talking about thousands of circuits that we're going to be essentially tapped into. And the delicacy that would require was something that only the British had at that point. Whereas the Americans had more of the resources to pull off an operation like this. This was going to be quite expensive, and Britain, of course, was still in the years after World War II in quite a state of economic disrepair, and they certainly didn't really have the funds to do an operation like this. So it kind of worked out well for the Americans to supply the Corps of Engineers to do the actual tunnel construction, and then have the Royal engineers on hand to do some of the specialty work. So the tunnel itself was the construction. Once the teams were put into place, they had to, you know, build a warehouse on the American side, an Army warehouse that was going to serve as sort of the shield for this, the cover, so to speak, for this tunneling operation, because you couldn't just expect to start tunneling, you know, just 100 or 200 yards from the Soviet sector border and not have that being noticed. So the warehouse was constructed, and the tunnel would be launched from inside this warehouse from the basement. And by the time that all this is put in place, it's now the end of August 1954, when ground is broken on the tunnel, so to speak, and the Corps of Engineers started digging. And this was something that had to be done by hand, because you were so close to the Soviet border, and this tunnel was going to have to be dug fairly close to the surface, that you couldn't have tunneling equipment down there. It would have to be dug by hand by the engineers, using their little entrenching tool shovels, the sort that a GI would carry in, on their packs. And it was painstaking work, and it took 6 months of teams working around the clock, 24 hours a day, six men at a time, just inching forward. And they built a little makeshift railroad with on wooden tracks, using an electric forklift that would pull the sandbags full of fill back to the warehouse. And they were putting in steel liner that had been specially constructed and shipped to Berlin, which of course meant when you're shipping something to Berlin of that size, you're having to go through East German territory, Soviet controlled territory. And that was a bit hair raising, putting it on the military, American military train that had one train a day would have access to running to Berlin. And they had managed to get all this to Berlin. And after 6 months of this work, they reached a spot that they believed was below the cables, a quarter mile long, from a quarter mile from the warehouse. And this was in February of 1955. And that's when the Royal Engineers took over, and their job was to dig straight up to reach the cables. And this, the soil there was so sandy that it was quite a difficult operation. And the team had put together a device they called the mole, which was described by one of the SIS officers as looking like a cross between a Venetian blind and a barbecue grill. They over the course of a month were able to get up to reach the cables and find that indeed the Corps of Engineers had perfectly calculated the distance to reach the cables. And they were, once they had a sort of a tap chamber set up, which would allow the tapping team to go in and do their work, that it was already by then close to May of 1955. And that's when the painstaking and very delicate work of tapping the lines began. And yeah, that was itself quite hair raising.
Right. Yeah. Because by tapping the line, you can change the voltage, and that can be picked up by the Soviets, that there's taps on the line, isn't it? So it's a very delicate process, but delighted to hear about the British expertise being used there.
Yeah,
Steve.
It was, that's exactly right, because any change in the voltage on these lines could expect to be immediately detected. So they had to they'd built actually an entire really state-of-the-art equipment chamber right beneath the highway in East Berlin where these cables were running. And so there this equipment chamber looked like the command center of a battleship. It's one guy described it to me that way. Another said it was like spick and span hospital operating room. This despite the muddy conditions that they'd encountered down below. But with this equipment, they were able to to maintain a steady levels of current on the lines and do the tapping. The British had flown in a couple of veterans of the operation in Vienna. These were gents who had actually fought with Montgomery's 8th Army in from the Normandy landing all the way to Berlin, doing some of the telecommunications work, and they now were brought in for this project, and it was extraordinarily I guess you could say nerve-wracking for them, because you could hear the traffic right overhead. And one of the SIS officers, Peter Montagnon, described being absolutely petrified that a tank was going to roll overhead just as they were doing their work, and the whole thing would collapse on them. But somehow they pulled it off, and you had the teams back in the warehouse with 150 recorders that were set up for this, and they're holding their breath as well. And on this night in they did it in the middle of the night when there would be less chance of the operation being detected. On this night in May 1955, they tapped the first of three cables, and they were in business.
And instantly seeing really useful intelligence come through as well.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was order of battle type stuff that they didn't have. They knew very little about the Red Army, and even where many of its units were, or the command structure, or their doctrine. So they're putting together more or less little bits and pieces, putting together a mosaic of Soviet capabilities. So a lot of it was not any one golden piece of information, although the big thing, of course, that they were looking for was any indication that the Soviets were mobilizing for an attack. And oftentimes for that kind of information, it's not so much a general officer that they're going to learn this from. It's going to be from the clerks down at the unit level, say at company level, who's talking to another clerk, and they're making logistical arrangements for using the railroads, or moving a communications set up closer to the border. Sort of thing would have been the real tip off that any kind of attack was planned. And so they had people monitoring for that sort of stuff while the rest of it was being recorded.
Right. I was going to ask you, I mean, obviously there were the British military liaison units and the US units and the French units that were allowed to travel around East Germany. Were they not particularly effective in gaining any insight during this period?
Oh, no, they were pretty effective. And I think the British in particular were quite successful at getting some good information. And in fact, one of the most important spies of the era, Popov, the Soviet GRU officer, who had earlier began spying for the Americans and British while in Vienna, and had shown up in East Germany unbeknownst to the West. And it was thanks to one of those British military teams traveling in East Germany that he was able to make contact with the West again. That wasn't going to be on a scale large enough to really find out what the Red Army was up to on a larger scale. That provided some good information here and there, but it wasn't going to more than likely get into intent. And plus, those guys were being, of course, monitored the entire time that they were traveling around East Germany. So it was a different type of intelligence that they're getting.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great little story, that of Popov and the British military liaison unit in the book, amongst many other nuggets of gold, if you can excuse the pun there. One of the stories I particularly like was the loose-lipped wife of the general, who was giving some rather interesting tidbits.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Right. So you had the commander of the group of Soviet forces in Germany, Marshal Gretschko, five-star general who didn't know his lines were being tapped, but it was his wife who was constantly giving little tidbits of information. She was heartily disliked by the various Soviet officers who had to deal with her because she was, constantly making these demands and for tips on new fur coats that she could get off the black market or carpets that she could ship back to Moscow, that sort of thing. But, a lot of that is sort of gossip tittering type stuff. But with that, they were able to put together a picture of the scale of Soviet black market operations and the dislike that these Germans had for the Soviets. But more importantly than that, when Khrushchev gave his secret speech back in Moscow at the 20th Party Congress in 1956, some of the first information that the West gets from gets that this has occurred comes from Marshal Gretschko's wife, among others, who were making calls back to relatives in Berlin, with little hints about what's been going on, and that was the basis for the West soon learning about this rather earth-shaking speech that Khrushchev had given, denouncing Stalin and setting forth a number of big developments in the communist world, including eventually the Sino-Soviet split.
Yeah. Yeah. However, unbeknownst to the Americans and the British, the tunnel has been betrayed to the Soviets even before it was built.
The story there, of course, centers around George Blake, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with him, but his story is pretty remarkable in my view. Probably one of the most remarkable of the entire Cold War. Even when he enters this story, he's already had a pretty remarkable life. He was born to a man of Turkish descent who had fought for the British Army in World War I and had been assigned to Holland at the end of World War I and married a Dutch woman. And their son, George, was named after the king. But the young George's father had died when the boy was still relatively young. And he was sent to Egypt to live with more wealthy relatives who could see to his schooling. He lived on an island in the Nile and then was back in the Netherlands with his Dutch relatives, his mother and the other relatives, when the Nazis invaded Holland in 1940, and he went underground and was a courier for the Dutch resistance for about a year or so, and makes this after a year of that pretty dangerous service, makes an escape across Europe. He fears he's going to be arrested because he's a British citizen, and he makes his way through France and crosses the Pyrenees and through the snow and gets to Spain and then to England, where he joins the Royal Navy. And by virtue of the fact that he's had this life of underground experience, he's He speaks several languages quite well. He's pretty soon recruited into the British intelligence and, you know, ends up working in Holland for SIS at the end of the war. And he's quite well thought of by his superiors and is sent to Seoul, Korea, just in 1949, just before the war breaks out. And when the war breaks out, he's taken captive along with some other British diplomats. He's the chief of the British SIS station in Seoul. He undergoes 3 years of captivity, makes several attempts at escaping, and but at some point during his captivity, decides to switch sides. Devastating decision for Western intelligence. And so when he comes back, when he's released in 1953, along with the other diplomats, gets a hero's welcome and is brought back into the fold at SIS and in spring 1953. And he's given fairly soon after that a very sensitive position. It's Section Y at the Secret Intelligence Service, where he's one of the very handful, very few people who learn anything about this planned tunnel. This is before the tunnel is even being built, before, you know, even one spade full of dirt has been dug at this point. But he gets word, he meets with his Soviet KGB handler in London on a double-decker bus in January of 1954, and is able to pass on word about the plans for this tunnel. But the KGB, his handler, and the senior leadership back in Moscow are reluctant to do anything about this, because if they do anything to stop this tunnel, it's going to blow Blake sky high. You know, you're talking about only 3 or 4 people in the intelligence service who know about this tunnel. If the Soviets do anything to stop it, it's going to point the finger very quickly at Blake. And so not only do does the KGB not do anything to stop the tunnel, they don't even really spread the word to anyone outside a very close circle. We're talking 3, 4, 5 senior officials, and Ivan Serov, the head of the KGB, and a couple of his deputies. So they don't tell anything to the KGB resident in East Berlin at Karlshorst. They don't say anything, of course, to the Red Army, including Gretschko, the marshal, who's the commander of all Soviet forces in Germany. They decide that Blake is too valuable to risk doing anything to stop this tunnel. So it is quite an irony that the Soviets know about this tunnel but are afraid to do anything about it.
And so therefore the British and the Americans are still getting really valuable intelligence about all the information you've described, such as order of battle and all those details. So how long does the KGB allow the tunnel to remain in operation before they try and close it?
Well, it goes on for quite a time, for close to a year. And, you know, the part of the issue was the KGB, Blake, before the tunnel, or right as the tunnel is about to come online, is transferred from London to Berlin, where, ironically, he is less able to get information about the tunnel or what's happening with the tunnel than when he was in London, because in London at his job at Section Y, he's supposed to know about the tunnel. But once he's transferred to Berlin, his job doesn't include knowledge of the tunnel, because the tunnel was so secret that Peter Lunn, who was in charge of the SIS station in Berlin, hadn't shared the information about it with any of his deputies. So only his chief deputy knows anything about it, but no one else at the station knows anything about it. Same with the CIA. Bill Harvey, the chief of the Berlin operations base, only shares this information with one or two people. So Blake technically no longer knows anything about the tunnel. He can't be asking around about the tunnel. He can't ask Peter Lund, his boss, about the tunnel, because that would raise red flags. That he is able to pass on some general information that the tunnel is operating, but the KGB doesn't really recognize at first the scale of the information that's being lost. Plus, you know, the KGB being a bureaucracy and a rather cold-blooded one at that, isn't so concerned, because most of the lines being tapped are the belong to the Red Army. Now, some of the KGB lines, and also some of quite a few of the GRU, the Soviet military intelligence lines, are being tapped, but they don't care about the GRU either, for that matter.
Yeah, there's no love lost between those two.
none whatsoever. And so it's one of these. It's almost like a comical bureaucratic snafu in a way, where the KGB's not really focused on the intelligence that's being lost. And eventually, though, Serov, the chief of the KGB, begins to think he probably should give some warning to the Red Army. And so we'd mentioned earlier that that the Vienna operation had been disclosed by Blake. Serov gives Bulganin, Nikolai Bulganin, who was then the defense minister in the Kremlin, information about the Vienna operation, passing along this information that Blake had given them. So he's more or less, the KGB is more or less warning the Red Army that, you know what, telephone lines are not secure. They were able to intercept a lot of information in Vienna. So you should be on the alert for other operations like this. And essentially the Red Army command says, yes, yes, of course. And then, you know, promptly doesn't really do anything to tighten up their telephone security. So you had general officers such as Grechko and others who are not following the highest telephone security protocol, and quite a bit of information is getting out that way. Plus, as mentioned earlier, you have all the logistical people and this mosaic that's being built painstakingly. And you have hundreds of people in London and Washington who are analyzing this information. They don't know where it's coming from. They don't know about the tunnel. But they've assembled these teams of translators and analysts. In London, the voice tapes, we're talking hundreds of these tapes being made, are being flown on a nearly basis, daily basis to London to be transcribed and translated and analyzed. You just have teams just pouring over this material. And then the same thing is going on in Washington with the teletype information, which is also, you know, the same thing is happening with that. So it takes oftentimes months for this material to be analyzed. So you also have a team right there in Berlin, small team that's going over looking for any actionable intelligence that, you know, is of immediate importance, or any sign that the tap has been discovered. But over the course of some months, then you're beginning to assemble volumes of information, so much so that they were worried that in Washington, in this temporary building down near the Lincoln Memorial that was housing the operation, they were worried that these safes on the second floor were going to collapse through the creaky floorboards, and you know, the whole building was going to fall down.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm surprised it didn't. You know, there weren't other leaks, because if you were transcribing these phone calls, it's pretty obvious they're phone calls, and they're going to be talking about Berlin and that area or those sort of areas. So it's incredible that it, you know, it didn't get out through other means other than Blake.
Right. And that was a huge fear. You know, the fear in Washington was that if the Soviets, all they would have to know was that 100 translators were meeting, were coming to working in this building every day to know that something big was up. The same thing in London. So that was a constant fear. So of course, the security was highly emphasized. But yes, it is surprising that that something didn't get out. And indeed, yeah, the CIA and SIS assume that for that reason, this tunnel is not going to stay secret forever by any means. It wasn't like a huge shock when when the Soviets did indeed shut it down.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lovely story you tell where whilst the operation is going on, there's a light snowfall. And because the earth around the tunnel is slightly warmer, you can clearly see this line going from this warehouse out into the Soviet zone. But luckily, I think the snowfall gets thicker and it stops showing. And then there's this big scramble to put in some cooling system to make sure that doesn't happen again. So there's some lovely stories in here, and I have to compliment you on the way that you've written this, because it's not a dry intelligence history that, you know, you can sometimes read. It's a good read. It reads like a novel, and is a great piece of work. So I wanted to talk a bit about Blake, because as you say, he is a very interesting character. Up until the Korean War, are there any signs of left wing sympathies in him or not?
Yes. By his account, and I did interview him for the book, although my talks with him were focused pretty heavily on the tunnel itself. But in the in his memoir, and also in a confession that he wrote, or more or less a statement he gave to his defense attorneys after his arrest, he lays out in great detail, quite interestingly, how this transformation came. He described himself early on as a fervent anti-communist and someone who was brought up hating the Germans and the Russians and so forth. But that his in looking back on his life, he sees his time in Egypt. When he was living with his wealthy relatives, one of his cousins who was living with the family there was a student at Cairo University and was involved with left-wing politics, would later be the founder of the Egyptian Communist Party. And he would take George, who was then a 13 or 14-year-old boy, out to the slums, to the real parts of Cairo, away from this this palace where they lived, and he would see the haves and have-nots of the world, and how poor the multitudes of people in Egypt were, and that made an impression on him. He's someone who was pretty impressionable, I think, at that time, and ironically, what he also describes as having a big impact on his development is, as part of his training at SIS in the late 40s, they're all given an explanation of communism and its appeal to the third world and to the displaced of the world. And it was written by an SIS officer very objectively, but in Blake's reading, he relates that he began thinking, well, you know what? I can understand why communism appeals to so many people. It seems to have quite a bit going for it. And then when he's being held as a prisoner in Korea, they're given copies of Das Kapital to read. They don't have much in the way of books other than Treasure Island and a few other things. And
I know which one I'd choose, but anyway.
Yeah, well, they went through them all many times. Put it that way.
Yeah.
It wasn't you didn't read one. It was you'd go through each book six or seven times. And the British minister in Seoul, who was also in captivity, had lost his eyeglasses and couldn't read. So Blake would sit there and read, you know, in their free time, he would read excerpts from these books, and they would discuss Marx's theories. And Blake just found himself being more and more entranced by the idea. You know, he was described by different people who knew him then as almost like a Walter Mitty type figure who was a bit malleable and someone who I think was drawn to the idea of holding secret power and by changing sides in the middle of the war that would position him to be uniquely capable of changing the course of the Cold War.
Right. Right. And how did they get on? How did SIS get onto him and work out who betrayed the tunnel?
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the story, because what happens is there's a Polish intelligence officer in the late 1950s, 1959 time frame, who begins passing on information to the CIA in Warsaw. And it shows these very sensitive SIS documents that very few people would have had access to were now in the hands of the KGB. And when the CIA passes on this information to the British, the British start an investigation. And Blake was one of essentially 10 SIS officers who would have had access to these documents. So he, among the others, is more or less, they go over his records. And the conclusion is that there's no possible way Blake could be a spy, because he was just so highly regarded. And so,
well, like Philby and Burgess. And
yeah, exactly. There's this reluctance, I think, in British intelligence to ever believe that one of their own could be a traitor. Blake benefited from that. And so the conclusion initially is that, the KGB probably got it from a burglary of a safe, SIS safe in Brussels. But that doesn't really hold water. And eventually they have to, you know, look at the investigation again, because more and more information is coming from this Polish intelligence officer, who then defects in early 1961 or late 1960. But right around that time period, he defects in Berlin, and with more hints that eventually lead to the more or less inescapable conclusion that George Blake must be the spy, and that takes place in April of 1961.
Right. So he's arrested and tried, but he's given a surprisingly long sentence for the time, isn't he? You know, a longer sentence than any other espionage case.
That's right. Yeah, it was the longest, in fact, the longest sentence in modern British legal history, 42 years, because the scale of the damage that he'd done was just so terrifying. Dick White, who headed SIS at the time, thought it was worse than Philby. It wasn't just the tunnel which had been betrayed, but just the names of hundreds of agents who were working for British intelligence. These are primarily East Germans who were reporting information to the British. Essentially, their entire intelligence network, more than once, because he was operating for so long, had been absolutely devastated by Blake's reporting. Just the amount of documents that he turned over to the Soviets, photographs. He essentially was a vacuum cleaner. Just almost anything he'd get his hands on would end up in the hands of the KGB. And this went on for almost 10 years. So the Macmillan, who was prime minister then, was terribly shaken by this. And feared that the government might fall on it. And he was pushing for a very stern sentence to both to show the Americans, who, needless to say, after Philby, we're not going to be terribly happy about having another British trader discovered, but also the British public, reassure them that you know, his government was taking firm action against spies. And so the sentence that he ends up getting is was considered, even by Macmillan himself, once it was delivered, as being savage by British standards. He couldn't have been put to death because there was no death penalty for the Official Secrets Act under which he was being charged. But instead of giving him one maximum 14-year sentence, they gave him three piled up consecutively, one after the other. So he got 42 years. And
right.
And then, of course, that eventually leads to his decision to escape.
So he gives a lot of information to British intelligence, though, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. He's quite cooperative, both in his confession. He makes that after his arrest. But then also, while being held at Wormwood Scrubs, he regularly met with MI5 to, you know, give them all the information he had about different Soviets who were operating in Great Britain and elsewhere in Western Europe. Just really anything he could share, he passed along. It wasn't as if he was going to lessen his sentence.
It seems odd, because if he's an ideological agent, which he obviously was, then why help the capitalist West in terms of being able to apprehend agents? It seems, you know, contradictory, to say the least.
It's a very valid question. Yeah, I think my take is that Blake, though he's you know, quite self-deprecating, mild-mannered, and all that, I think he has quite an ego. He's quite hugely proud of what he accomplished. I think he liked the idea of letting the British know how much damage he'd done. I think that might have been part of his motivation. He wanted to let them know that he had done quite a bit of damage.
Yeah. So you know, he's holding out for a while, hoping for a spy exchange with the Soviets that doesn't materialize. But what another thing that surprised me was how popular he appeared amongst the inmates in Wormwood Scrubs.
Yeah, I mean, he was surprised by that too. I mean, he's kind of you know, by all accounts, he's a, you know, a friendly person. He was a good listener and sympathetic, and you know, the prisoners, a lot of them, I mean, some of them thought he should have been hung, but others, you know, took a liking to him because Blake was always helping them with things. He would, you know, help them write letters to their lawyers, or he would teach a French class, or teach German to other inmates. He was always helping people, and even though, as I said earlier, I think he does have quite an ego, he's also isn't someone who acts arrogantly or puts others down. So I think people took a liking to him. And his other theory is that the length of his sentence just made him a star, more or less, among the other prisoners, because you know, prisoners are some of them anyway are going to have sympathy for someone who's given such a long sentence. And that, together with his personality, won him a lot of friends over the course of the 6 years that he was there, and more than a few of them were in the end willing to help him escape.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting one is, and I can't remember the guy's name, but there was somebody who was part of a right-wing organization who was sympathetic and was quite pleased that Blake had managed to make it over the wall.
Yeah, he was. He'd worked. He'd been on Chamberlain's cabinet, and his name is escaping me briefly too. But Blake had more than one friend who was definitely on the right side of the political scale, but there was something about him that made him quite popular. And then when he did get over the wall, some of the prisoners who were there that night just describe it as just the happiest day in the life of Wormwood Scrubs, that everybody was just, they were, you know, singing for "He's a Jolly Good Fellow." And, everybody was acting as if it was Christmas time, all around the prison. And, I think even by those accounts, even some of the screws, as the guards were known, were secretly pleased.
Yeah.
So it's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause whilst he's in there, he, gets into conversation with two peace activists, Michael Randall and Pat Pottle. I mean, what are their reasons for wanting to assist him, aside from their left-wing sympathies?
Yeah, they're both anti-nuclear activists who had been sentenced to prison for their role in one of the big anti-nuclear demonstrations, trying to shut down one of the U.S. Air Force bases. And they met Blake at the music appreciation class that the prison held, and they were taken by his personality, but they also began to see him as a fellow political prisoner. They saw themselves as political prisoners. They saw him as a political prisoner, not by their account. And I interviewed Randall about this, not because that they approved of his espionage, but because they thought that the length of Blake's sentence made him a political prisoner, that, the fact that they gave him such a long sentence meant that had been done to appease the Americans and, not for the proper judicial reasons. And they felt that, when Blake, Pottle had offered to help, and then they stay in contact after they're released from prison. When Blake makes the request through a third party, they're quite willing to help.
Yeah, and the whole story of the escape is pretty amazing in itself, with, you know, how he's got back to the Eastern Bloc. So aside from the absolutely riveting story of Operation Gold, the story of Blake and his escape and the assistance he's given by Randall and Pottle is fascinating. You managed to speak to Blake. Was that a big surprise that you actually managed to talk to him? I'm presuming it was.
Yeah. I felt like I couldn't tackle this book without at least making an attempt to speak with him, given he's still alive and, you know, even to this day, 97 years old. So I tried through various sources to find a telephone number or other contact information for him. I didn't want to go through the Russian intelligence service because I felt that would go nowhere. Just as a journalist, I thought the best thing would just be to call him out of the blue. And when I succeeded in getting his telephone number, that's what I did. I called him out of the blue, and I think more out of politeness than anything else, he was willing to speak to me for a while. I think he was interested in the questions to some extent. And then I later made a second attempt to interview him by going out to Moscow, and he was found his dacha, and unfortunately he was ill at the time, but didn't succeed in setting up a second telephone interview, which was also useful. So I didn't go into the project thinking I had a great chance of speaking to him, but in the end it
so you got his number, called him, and he just picked up the phone and you started chatting.
His wife picked it up, and but yeah, he's just I kind of felt that it would be it's a bad idea to ask permission to speak to someone. It's better just to call and start speaking to them and see what happens.
Is that lesson number one at journalism school?
That would be the first lesson I would teach anyway.
No, that's really interesting. So obviously the Operation Gold is not discovered by the Soviets, but they stage something to make it look as though they found it by accident.
Yeah, that was a pretty elaborate charade, but I think eventually the scale of the damage that was being done was becoming more apparent, and they came up with this idea to more or less wait for a bad weather event, in this case heavy rain that caused a lot of short circuits in the all across the East German or all across the Berlin communications network on both sides of in all sectors east and west to act. They had the tunnel at this by this point was also had been made known to Khrushchev and Bulganin, who were more or less the dual leaders at that time. Bulganin was the premier, and Khrushchev, ironically, in particular, they were planning for their first visit to Great Britain. This was in April of 1956, and Khrushchev thought this would be a perfect opportunity for a propaganda coup. He was quite interested in more or less exploiting and fanning a difference, a split between the Americans and the British. And his idea was to blame the tunnel entirely on the Americans and completely ignore the fact that the British, of course, were co-conspirators on this, and use it to fan anti-American sentiment, both in East Germany, but also in Great Britain, to kind of show the Soviet Union as interested in peace and prosperity and being friendship with the British people. And if only the Americans weren't so nasty and bent on a Cold War, we could work together and live together in happy harmony. And the Soviets set up this incredible propaganda operation right when Khrushchev and Bulganin were arriving in Great Britain. And once the tunnel was discovered, the CIA and SIS had assumed that the Soviets would keep it quiet, but instead they called every reporter in Berlin out to Karlshorst, and they brought them down to the tunnel site. This is during the night, and it was just became this mad scene, the biggest espionage story of the day back then. And the reporters were brought down into the tunnel, and nobody could believe what they saw. This incredibly elaborate equipment chamber beneath the highway, and the tunnel leading directly back, across the border to the U.S. Army warehouse. And it went on for days and days, and then they opened up the whole tunnel to the world, and it became one of the biggest tourist attractions in Berlin for months. You had some 90,000 people toured through the tunnel, from east and west, school Wow. groups, workers from the factories, diplomats, you name it, college students. They all went through the tunnel and took photographs, and the whole time the Soviets were trying to hammer on the Americans using West Berlin as a nest of spies, and the hope was that they could force the Americans out. But that didn't happen in the end. And in fact, it more or less boosted the reputation of the CIA and British intelligence. Well, not British intelligence so much, because they weren't associated with, but certainly the CIA, that they were able to pull a fast one on the KGB, because no one had really thought that was possible at that time.
Yeah, but once they realized that Blake had betrayed the tunnel, the general view is that Operation Gold was a disaster, because the Right. Russians knew it was going on. But you argue differently, that there was that Gold was a success in its own right.
Right. Once it became known that Blake had betrayed the tunnel, because that wasn't known right away. It really it wasn't until after his escape that this became Blake landed in Moscow, and later, after a couple years, gave a interview to Izvestia, the Soviet newspaper. It wasn't until then, the Soviet news service. It wasn't until then that that it became publicly known that the Blake had betrayed the tunnel. And so at that point, you know, the tunnel became something of a laughingstock in various accounts that surfaced in subsequent years. And it became, the assumption was that, well, if the KGB knew about the tunnel from the start, of course it was a complete joke. This whole thing was, disinformation, and they only put out planted information and so on and so forth. That was more or less the accepted view. And it's only, I think, more in recent years, as some of the records be declassified, and the fact that participants in the tunnel on both sides could be interviewed, that we can put together what really happened, and actually by a sheer analysis of the amount of phone calls that were being intercepted, it was in the end over 400,000 communications. There was no way you could fake 400,000 calls, or even if you're only faking 1,000 of those 400,000 calls, the 399,000 genuine calls would expose the fake information as being fake. So in the end, and this is what Blake's handler, Sergei Kondrashov, would later say, that they had no chance of putting in disinformation, because that too would have blown Blake, and they decided that Blake was more valuable to them than the tunnel.
Yeah. And through the intelligence that the British and the Americans were getting, that it lessened their fears of a first strike from the Soviets, so therefore reduced the chances of war.
Right. You know, and I spoke to Khrushchev's son about this. He's living in America. He's a professor.
Yeah, I did an interview with him last year, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating guy, Sergei.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And his book about the creation of Nikita Khrushchev and the creation of a Soviet empire, as it's called. That's a fascinating book. And he had some interesting observations, and he feels his father's attitude once he learned about the tunnel was let them hear. We the more they know. In some ways, the better, because he felt that since they weren't planning any kind of attack, he thought it was good for the Americans to know that. He just wasn't concerned about the information that was being lost. Khrushchev himself didn't address it in his memoir, so we don't know for sure what his thinking was. But that's his son's view.
Yeah. Yeah. And in all the research that you did on the book, what was the thing, or was there anything where you thought, my goodness, I never realized that? Or were there a few?
Yeah. I mean, really, the whole thing, talking to, some of the, everything from the GIs who were back there, where the tapes where the equipment was being held, and just realizing that that most of the people, even at the American warehouse, didn't know about the tunnel, because they were they had a fake operation where the warehouse was actually a radar station. So most of the GIs there knew nothing about the tunnel. The fact that most of the people at the CIA base who were working directly with Bill Harvey knew nothing about the tunnel. To me, the fact that they were able to have such a level of secrecy for an operation, even within a itself a highly secret base like the Berlin operations base, to me was pretty astonishing. That the levels of compartmentalization that existed, and yet the fact that the whole thing was actually known to the KGB just adds that another level of irony to the whole thing.
Steve, that has been really interesting. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise.
I think we've tantalized the listeners sufficiently for them to rush out and hopefully buy a copy. If you like what you're hearing, sign up to our email list at coldwarconversations.com. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.